Victory. A big event for the village was the coming of the evacuees. A school from London's East End arrived with their teacher, and homes and school had to be arranged for them. All houses were checked for size and number of occupants, and if there was room for one or more children, you had to take them. Mother was relieved that her four counted as sufficient for one home, but everyone rallied to the need, and with the great spirit that the war brought out, even in hitherto rather aloof people, places were found for all. The village school did double duty, Ashcott children using it in the mornings, and the Londoners in the afternoons. It was fortunate for the evacuees that all were housed in the village or its immediate surrounds and met together at the school, because it must have been a terrible experience for children to find themselves in such a different setting from their London homes. Many had come from very deprived backgrounds. The local people tried hard to make them feel welcome, but it was all so strange. The fact that they had one another was the one constant in a totally alien world. But they too had their share of bravery, and I think most of them managed to cope. Some indeed made great friends with their host families and returned after the war to stay with them for holidays. We made a few friends amongst them, although the opportunity for seeing them to speak didn't often arise. We were rather cut off with not going to the local school. A group of them started up a little feud with us, climbing up on our gate and taunting us. No doubt we did look a bit odd. Boo and I often ran out to play in the garden with our hair unplaited, hanging down in a tangled mass. We must have appeared to be cave dwellers or characters from prehistoric times. One day the ringleader of this little group actually climbed over the paddock gate and advanced towards us threateningly. I was scared stiff. She was only a little girl about my size, but we hadn't bargained for this. Mind you, we deserved it. We had given them as good as we'd got in the calling out match. As I was the eldest on our side, and there were older and smaller children in our garden who had come to play, I felt it incumbent upon me to rise to the fight. I marched forward with fists at the ready, anticipating a struggle, quaking with fear inside. We approached each other with calculated steps, each eyeing her opponent carefully. Just as I was about to thump, she did the unexpected, and I thought cowardly thing. Up came one foot, and she kicked me in the tummy. It wasn't a very hard kick, and did me no physical harm, but it damaged my pride severely, and I fled the battle. To our relief, she did too, when she heard my yell, and after that there were no more skirmishes. We got to know their names in time, and all was forgotten. Meanwhile, Bridget was growing into a bonny little girl, with bright brown eyes, rosy cheeks, and a dark complexion. We loved her. Father often called her the Queen. And in fact, on May the 1st each year, for those growing years, we used to gather wild flowers to make a little circlet and crown her Queen of the May. She looked forward to this each year. She used to get a small gift in honour of the occasion, and she would speak of my May Queen, rather as she did of my birthday. The rationing system was carefully planned so that small children were entitled to extra bodybuilding foodstuffs. Under fives had a green ration book, older children had blue ones, and adults buff. This assured, as far as possible, that the nation's growing children were provided with at least the basic provisions for healthy growth. On the green ration book could be obtained a regular supply of cod liver oil, hated by all, but very good for you. Concentrated orange juice was also available on these books for the price of a postage stamp. It was a valuable source of vitamin C and much more pleasant. Sometimes, when a certain food was in short supply, a notice would go up in the shop window, only on green ration books, so that the little ones would not be deprived. And everyone understood and respected this. Powdered milk, dried eggs, margarine instead of butter, these were the facts of living. But with homegrown or local grown fruit and vegetables, little Bridget thrived, as did the rest of us. The evacuees didn't stay very long. I can't remember how long, but they had all gone back to London before some of the worst bombing took place. Their coming had, however, not been without its message for Ashcot. Although none of us realised it at the time, the village was beginning to change. As the years passed, the change accelerated until the pre-war fabric had almost entirely disintegrated. Outside influences from a rapidly changing world began to slip in. Just as the First World War had been the end of an era, so too was the second one, though in a different way. I remember one hard day we all had to face. A notice went up on the village green notice board that all iron fences, gates and railings were required for making munitions and would be removed. We were very anxious because although we only had one little iron gate at the end of the front path, it opened onto a flight of 5 steep steps down onto the road. If there were no gate, a toddler could be down those steps before anyone could rescue him. We hoped those concerned with the collection would appreciate our dilemma. But no, a big lorry came round the village, and the man took everyone's gate off its hinges and removed it to make bombs. Our little gate went too. And although most people in time made or bought wooden ones, we couldn't afford one. However, no one ever did fall down the steps. There was a very frightening day when a bomber raid took place in broad daylight. We were all in the stone-flagged courtyard at the back of the house, looking up into the blue sunlit sky, watching the bombers flying over, high up but clearly visible. And then suddenly there was the terrible whine of a falling high-explosive bomb. We ran frantically indoors, but then nothing. Silence. For a long time we felt the explosion must come, but it didn't. Apparently the bomb had fallen in a field near the high street, but had not gone off. Experts came and rendered it safe. But it made us realise that we were vulnerable, despite our distance from any large town. On another occasion, 2 oil bombs fell in an orchard close by our house. These did go off, but because there was nothing nearby to ignite the oil, no fire ensued. The trees, hedges, and lane were bespattered with oil, and bits of twisted metal from the bombs were scattered over a wide area. Children collected them as souvenirs, Ashcot bombs, and played with them. At night, after dark, we would lean out of the bedroom windows and watch the long fingers of the searchlight beams criss-crossing and feeling about in the sky as they tried to locate planes overhead. We used to hope they would miss them. During the day and at night, we often heard anti-aircraft guns, but we presumed they were practicing, and they probably were. Convoys of troops and equipment frequently went along the main road through the village. First a few soldiers on khaki-painted motorbikes, then jeeps, followed by bigger vehicles, army lorries full of supplies and troops, and sometimes cruel-looking tanks trundling along our peaceful Somerset roads. We used to stand at the side of the road and watch, waving to the soldiers, as children will, taking it all in and fascinated by it. We had heard Father speaking about his war, so we were not unaware of the seriousness of the manoeuvres, although mercifully we could not understand the full horror of it. Barrage balloons were another familiar wartime sight, not actually in Ashcot, but not far away. These huge silvery-grey monsters floated about, high enough to dissuade attack from low-flying aircraft. Nets were held between the balloons, and they looked quite grotesque. Once Father took Boo and me on a long walk to Western Zoyland Aerodrome, which was quite a busy wartime airbase. We could see it from above when we walked along the top of the hills. And as we were very keen on planes at that time, Father said we would try to walk there. No other transport was available. It was a long walk, and we were able to go right onto the runways and look at a couple of planes. A Spitfire was standing there for inspection. I think it must have been some kind of an open day, unless the men in charge were very lenient, because they let us climb into it. Before we left, we saw, in another part of the aerodrome, a bomber loaded with bombs, and we knew it was destined to wreak havoc on some innocent town or village. We walked away from it, weighed down with heavy thoughts, and began to go across the runway in the direction of home. Then we became aware of a red light flashing on and off urgently. We calmly looked around, wondering what it was all about, and then suddenly, directly over our heads, swept in a landing plane. We hadn't known it was coming because of the speed of its approach, but of course the control tower had, and was frantically trying to warn us of our danger. We left soon after that. It was one of those near disasters that happen so quickly that we don't realise their magnitude at the time. Afterwards, we knew how lucky we had been. As Boo and I grew older, into our early teens, we began to take what we felt was a more active part in the war effort. We had already been helping on the domestic side with the growing and gathering of crops and wild fruit, but now the government were taking new initiatives to acquire funds for the armed forces. Events were organised all over the country, and everyone was asked to cooperate where and as they could. Some of the cities and towns put on ambitious ventures. People rose to the challenge, and a lot of talents emerged. Songs were written, entertainments of various kinds produced, and imaginative ways thought out for getting cash. The villages hadn't as much to draw on in the way of expertise or wherewithal, but had easily as much keenness and enthusiasm. There were three big fundraising drives over the years, called Salute the Soldier Week, Warship Week, and Wings for Victory, to raise money for each of the armed forces in turn. The event that affected our own family most was the bring and buy sale. This involved most of the village in some capacity or other. There was usually a dance in the village hall, even though most of the younger men and women were away in the forces, the music being played on the piano, or, more grandly, by a small band. There were no discos then, they came much later. School children put on an afternoon entertainment of sketches and songs, with occasionally an adult taking part as a conjurer or ventriloquist. But both old and young came to the bring and buy. You brought anything you either wanted to get rid of or felt you could spare in the way of household goods and bric-a-brac, as well as things you had made especially for the occasion. A few housewives even managed, despite the meagre rations, to make and bring home bakery, which were, of course, snapped up at once. Many were the recipes that the enterprising cooks thought up for cakes without eggs, sometimes even without fat and with a minimum of sugar. Anything was a treat that had, with a little ingenuity, been made to look appetizing and different. Boo and I worked hard beforehand with our needles and bits of material scrounged from other people's rag bags. any kind of soft toy sold well, and lavender bags, and baby's bibs. We had a little stall of our own, and stood behind it when the great afternoon came, proudly selling our wares, and feeling we had done so much for the war effort when we came to hand in our takings. Well, we had. And often we didn't even have the penny or tuppence required to buy ourselves a cup of tea or a little bun. It was hard work, but it was all fun. And I think that was one of the main fruits of those weeks. I suppose a lot of money was raised, but that would have soon been spent. Of more lasting value was the working together towards a goal. Every area had its own target, and the enjoyment of everyone who participated. Friendships were forged, people felt good, and made others feel good. On one occasion, an elderly lady who lived alone had nothing to give to the bring and buy, but wanting to contribute something, for she was very patriotic, went into her garden and cut her whole lovely patch of hyacinth. It was springtime, and she had watched eagerly for them to bloom. That day, on an impulse, she cut them down, put them in a pail of water, and brought them to the bring and buy. Because people were on the lookout more for necessities like edible goods, clothing and gifts, rather than the luxury of cut flowers, nobody bought them. As we left the hall, we saw them there still, in the pail. We came home and told Father about it, because he didn't usually come to these events. Immediately, although he had no cash, he sent us back to get them, promising to send the money up later. When we got there, they were gone. We hurried to the lady's house, which was quite near, and found that somebody else had had the same feelings and hurried back to buy them after all. I tell this reminiscence because it highlights the spirit of concern and sensitivity of so many ordinary people living together through a time of so much trial and uncertainty. In spite of the harshness, the brutality, the senselessness of war, there yet remained a delicacy of touch in human nature that could not be fractured. One of us asked Father what was in the papers before the war, for there was nothing else in them all those years except what was in some way connected with war, despite the fact that all the information of any importance had to be kept secret. Even in advertisements, the pictures were always of people in uniform. It was a question Father remembered ever after. I could linger over many more memories of those war years, but it would make this book too long. Instead, I must turn to that day for which we had all prayed, hoped, and worked. Many had fought, and many had died. Victory. In the end, it really happened. The taut band of tension snapped, and everyone was free at last. A mighty surge of relief, untranslatable into words and impossible to describe to anyone who has never experienced it, swept through the land. Outwardly, nothing had changed, apart from the fact that the air raid sirens were heard no more and the blackout was ended. Rationing went on for almost as long again as it had already lasted. Everything was in as short supply as before. But oh, the lads came home demobbed, and the girls from the ATS and other services. Ascot was complete again, and everyone could celebrate. Families put out flags and bunting and welcome home signs outside their houses when they knew their dear ones would return. During the First War, the village had suffered heavy casualties, and unless my memory serves me false, I don't think we lost any of our men in this one. Some had been taken prisoner and took longer to get back, but I think they all eventually came home. There were parties, street by street, and lots of events, not this time to get money from people in order to make more weapons, but simply for joy. Everything was free. Those who had any cash, handing out prizes to the children when they won races. Those who hadn't, helping to collect tables together or lending cups, or at least a hand. There was relief and great happiness on every face. I know that for those elsewhere who had lost one or more members of their families, and there were so very, very many, there must have been an even greater sense of loss as they witnessed the homecomings and reunions. The pain was all around us, and even those who were the most energetic in the celebrations were aware of this other side, the price that had been paid. I was nearly 16 when VE Day brought peace to Europe, and not long past my birthday when Japan surrendered and we celebrated VJ Day. Boo was 14. Life was still just as curtailed by shortage of goods and of money as it had been, but by now we were getting quite clever at managing. Everyone still had to be. It was common practice to take an old, worn-out jumper or cardigan carefully to pieces, unpick the parts that were still good, wash the wool, and then knit it up into another garment. Fathers' worn trousers were cut down to make smaller ones for their sons. Ladies' dresses made children's skirts or frocks, and even furnishing materials like cretonne and butter muslin, which were not on coupons, were used to make clothing. In our house, if we needed something that cost money, we knew we would have to use our ingenuity to create it ourselves or go without. But it took a lot to beat us. Making things out of next to nothing was a challenge and usually fun. We made rugs out of snipped-up rags, not elegant, but long-lasting and serviceable. Nothing at all was wasted. Once in a while, a rag-and-bone man still came round, as of yore. He paid a few pence for a bundle of rags, but we never had any bones for him. What well-stewed bones we had finished with were eagerly snapped up by our dog or someone else's. Newspapers were never thrown away. They had several uses before being either composted or used as firelighters. A folded paper was always used as a chopping board for vegetables, another as a stand for hot saucepans, and others for putting on the floor to soak up spilt washing water. They were used under mats and carpets to help keep the cold of the stone floors a little further from our feet. And of course they were always used as toilet paper. Toilet rolls were rarely seen. In fact, it would have been considered unpatriotic to use them. Even public conveniences only offered newspapers readily cut into squares. Shops, too, were always glad of any spare papers to use as wrapping paper for their wares. When I see all the paper that is wasted today, and hear the few voices raised to try and tell people to save it, I remember those days. We knew well enough how to save and use every scrap of paper then. It is a skill that needs to be relearned, possibly not quite to the same extent, but at least in moderation. In spite of all this making and mending, and all the work that had to be done, with no labour-saving devices whatsoever, not even an electric iron or kettle, life was not pressurised in Ashcourt, or at any rate not in our own home. Looking back, I see how almost all the teaching our parents gave us was by example rather than in words, and it stood us in good stead in later years. One thing Mother always did, and which most of the other housewives didn't do, as far as we knew, was that once the washing up was done, after the midday meal, she would have her own daily wash. We always washed in the kitchen. Take off her morning working frock, put on a pretty one, and then settle down with her book for the afternoon. Whenever there was any sunshine, she'd sit in the sheltered, sun-trapped courtyard at the back of the house. She loved the sun. In winter, she would sit by the fire. She didn't get on with her sewing and mending. This she did in the evenings. There were always lots of socks to be darned and other garments to mend. The afternoon was for relaxing, and she sat reading, maybe keeping an eye on the youngest child at the same time, but otherwise just sitting there quietly. I think this had quite a specific effect on us all. Father would usually be sitting down at that time too, but he never sat in the sun. He'd sit indoors even in beautiful weather. His outdoor time was when he was gardening or walking. All this gave a tranquillity to the home and a great sense of peace and contentment. As we grew older and spent less time in active play, we too would settle down with our books. I often had my knitting at the same time, and read, or think the long, long thoughts of youth. Chapter 11. No Greater Gift. The following year was a very eventful one for our family. Two things happened which changed all our lives quite dramatically. One was the arrival of the new baby, Julian, at the end of the year. The other was that Boo and I went to school. Even when we were quite small, as we passed the convent school at Glastonbury on the bus, Father would say to us, "One day, perhaps, you will go to school there." It must have been something he longed for us to do. Yet the shortage of money, while he was still trying to pay for the house, and then the outbreak of war, had rendered the whole idea impracticable. While raids were a constant hazard, he and Mother wanted us all to be together, and we were all very happy in the Litchfield school. But now at last things were looking a little brighter. Also, the arrival in the village of a new headmaster for the local school may well have been a contributing factor to Father's decision to send us to school that year. This teacher and his family were Catholics, and we made great friends with them. When their little girl made her first communion, Boo and I were invited to the party at the convent which she attended, so we met some of the sisters and had our first introduction to the school. I am quite sure those sisters, after meeting us, prayed that we should go there. They knew that we were Catholics, yet did not appear in church. They would not have realized how impossible it was for people in the outlying villages to get there, especially those with children, so surmised that we were lapsed and needed to be helped back. I don't know all the ins and outs, but I do know that as the summer went on, there was talk of school, clothes, and all sorts of related things, yet no one had ever said to us that we were actually going there. In the end, we could bear the suspense no longer, and Boo tackled Father head-on. "Look here, Dad," she said firmly, "we want to know. Are we going to this school, or are we not?" This amused him highly. "Ultimatum from Boo," he exclaimed. He was smiling, and yet proud of his daughter's forthright approach. It must have galvanized him into action and settled his indecision. Mother's pregnancy would have been a factor against our going, because so much more would fall upon her with the two girls, by now quite useful, out of the house. However, from then on it was a definite fact that we would be starting at the convent in September, and Father never regretted taking this step. In any case, it must have been now or never as far as I was concerned, because at 17 I would already be one of the oldest girls at the school, and a little later I would have been too old to settle comfortably with the other pupils. Our father wanted so much for us to love learning. He had a powerful intellect, a quick wit, and a greatness of heart and mind that knew no bounds. He was also a very humble man, in the sense that he never took offence. He was always big enough to see life in its proper perspective. He had the right kind of pride, by which I mean self-respect and the ability to see and share in the best in other people. He was certainly very proud of all his children. He thought us wonderful, and of course proud of his wife. He had been born and brought up in Cambridge, and was baptized in Little St. Mary's. His family were Anglicans. We never discovered just when he became a Catholic, but felt it was probably during or immediately after the First World War, always referred to as Dad's War in our house, to distinguish it from the one we all lived through. He had two brothers and a sister, but sadly the little girl died of TB when she was about 12. He must always have been studious. He used to tell us, thinking to spur us on, how as a little boy he would sit at the old marble washstand in the bedroom he shared with one of his brothers, studying Greek, while the other lads were playing games in the street below. We considered this commendable, if not actually peculiar, but not something we felt called upon to emulate. We too had one of those old marble-topped washstands in the bedroom to use as a desk. You could pick them up very reasonably at sales. When visitors came, they were completed by a jug and bowl and matching soap dish and put to their proper use. These sets were important articles of furniture before bathrooms came into fashion, and often the chamber pot matched the jug and bowl. So guests were always provided with the ensuite facilities, though of a slightly different variety from today's contraptions, with their gurgling pipes and noisy cisterns. It was quieter and more poetic, and certainly more ecologically sound. Once, after Boo and I had gone to bed, I had occasion to need the chamber pot we shared. It must have been badly cracked, as were many of our household commodities, because when I sat on it that night it broke. The contents ran down the sloping bedroom floor, through the cracks, and into the hall below. We both hurried downstairs and went into our front room to tell our parents what had happened. They were sitting there quietly, and Mother was quite annoyed to see us. "You must have been playing about," she scolded. "No, I only sat on it," I explained. They found it hard to believe at first, but then I realized I was standing in something sticky. I looked down at my bare feet and found that they were in a little pool of blood on the linoleum. I must have been cut by the broken pot, but by such a sharp edge that I hadn't felt it. Mother fled into the kitchen. She couldn't bear the sight of blood, especially on her own children. Father had seen quite a lot of it during his lifetime, so he always took command on such occasions. He gently helped me to lie down on my front, on the floor, and kneeling beside me, wiped away the blood with a piece of rag. I shall never forget the infinite tenderness with which he patched the large cut with his one hand, using pieces of sticking plaster. Mother came in again once I'd been patched up, and we went back to bed, provided with an old paint can to use until such time as we could afford to buy another chamber pot. But I was writing about Father and his early days before that digression. He must have been a brilliant student, as well as a good sportsman. He used to tell us how, when as a boy, he had borrowed one of the very early bicycles from a friend. It had no free wheel. This was not developed until later, so that when he went downhill, you just lifted your feet off the pedals and let the machine take you, often at breakneck speed. I gather there were no brakes either. On this day, he had gone hurtling down a steep hill on one of the roads in Cambridge and crashed into a wall at the bottom. He managed to pick himself up, his face streaming with blood, and walked home. He wasn't seriously hurt, but felt very sorry for himself. He went into the house to his mother, but she must have been up to her eyes, as mothers of three lively lads often are, and she just looked up and said, "What now, great dink?" It wasn't that she wasn't a loving mother. He also had some lovely tales to tell about her, but that day it must have been the last straw. At university he became much involved with rowing, and we had several photographs from those days adorning the walls of our house. We also had an oar which had been presented to him, inscribed with the names of the boat crew, which he had been cox. He made lifelong friends amongst his fellow undergraduates, and was obviously in his element. He was very handsome by all accounts, tall, with a fine bearing and much charm. His interests were wide, and he loved life, and above all, people. There he was, a young man in his early 20s, with everything that could be desired, apart from money. And then the war came. With typical generosity, he enlisted in the Devon Regiment. I don't know whether this was a special reason for this choice of regiment, or if things just worked out that way. His father died 3 weeks before he was sent to the front. As an officer, he had to lead his men to almost certain death in that most terrible of all battles in Flanders, Passchendaele. The very name still strikes like a heavy weight on all who hear it and know of it. In October 1917, he was smashed by a shell. His right arm was completely shattered, and his legs had lumps of shrapnel in the thigh and calves. He was left amongst the innumerable dead, and he lay there, unconscious at first. Later he came to, and looking up, from where he lay in the stinking mud, full of half-rotting pieces of human bodies that was Passchendaele, he saw the stars. He had always loved them. He knew them all by name, knew the moon and the name of its landscapes. He was a keen astronomer. By the position of the stars, he knew which way to drag himself along, until he was picked up and carried to safety. He never lost consciousness again, or so he maintained. He remembered being on the hospital ship as they brought the wounded back to England, how the nurses had tried to get him to taste a little food or drink, but all he craved was a lemon. He had lost so much blood. He was in hospital for a very long time, over 4 years, although towards the end of that time he was intermittently back at Cambridge, coaching the rowing crews. The surgeons tried everything to restore the use of his right arm. They tried to transfer the tendons from one part to another. Modern replacement surgery had not yet been involved. But too much of the bone had gone, and in the end everyone realised that his arm would never be of use again. He couldn't bear the thought of having it removed altogether, so he kept it. I think he felt he would look more normal with something in his sleeve, even though the hand and arm could no longer be used. While he was in hospital, a friend for whom he used to write letters came to visit him, and the tables were turned as Michael wrote his letters for him. He had to learn to write with his left hand, and indeed do everything with it. But he had great spirit. I marvel now that no bitterness or resentment ever touched his life because of his disability. He had fought for his country and given his arm in order that we who came afterwards should live in peace, and he was proud to have shed his blood for his brothers. He had indeed laid down his life for them. The doctors were able to get his legs right, and in time they healed, which was a great blessing. After that war, probably more than after the second one, when everyone had become more disillusioned, the wounded soldiers were hailed as heroes, as indeed they were, and much was made of them. Opportunities were opened. I think it was during that time that Father studied criminal law and gained a degree in it. He never spoke of those intervening years between the end of the war and his marriage to Mother, which was not until 1928. He certainly enjoyed doing a kind of Sherlock Holmes act by searching out apparent mysteries in village life, but I don't think he ever did any professional work in that line. I'm sure that if we'd asked him, he would have told us, but when one is young, one's parents' past seems so very far back, even when in reality it's only a few years. Now that I'd be so interested to know, there is no one left alive who knew him then, so it is all hidden in the mysterious plan of God for us all. Ashcott life must have been very hard for Father in some ways. He loved his garden, his family, his books, but there was little stimulation for so active a mind. It was probably because of this that he used to go down to the local pub. We called it the inn in those days, and sit there talking to the locals and imbibing the strong Somerset cider. It didn't take a lot of that to make everyone unsteady on his feet, and the result was that he sometimes took more than he realised. He didn't get bad-tempered, just different from his normal dear self. Of course, it didn't often happen. He never went to the pub on Sundays, or days when we were doing something special at home. and usually when he did go, he came home none the worse. I think he found it difficult to refuse. It was part of his great enjoyment of everything in life. It was something we never spoke about, as though by some deep mutual agreement. At the time I used to worry. I didn't understand. With hindsight I see further. While Father was always the strong protector and defender, and the rock of support for us all, he too was vulnerable, and we in our turn needed to become a shield and ally in his time of weakness. We learned the first steps on the journey towards compassion, forbearance, and forgiveness. He was generous to a fault, and couldn't bear to see anyone in need if there was something he could do about it. His war pension was not increased as the family grew in size, and we all knew that he could never have been rich. If anyone had given him £1,000, he would soon have given it all away. He gave away his own clothes, even his only coat, one cold winter, to the various men who slept rough around the farms. Poor mother found this quite difficult at times. But her love always triumphed whatever he did, even though it was she who had to worry about shoes for the children and the growing bill at the grocer's. Somehow he always did manage. The bills ultimately got paid and we always had a meal. He had good friends and borrowed quite often. No one could refuse him. His visits to the Ashcot Inn were not without their fruits in other ways. Everyone who visited the village frequented it, and he met a lot of very interesting people, often quite famous ones. Some he would bring home and introduce to us all, and friendships began that have lasted the rest of our lives. He also loved the very poorest, who dossed down at night in disused farm buildings, and had no work or anyone to care for them. They occasionally earned a little by helping out the farmers at busy seasons, or they would snare a rabbit and sell it, or gather bunches of watercress. They were hard hit by the rationing system, because most of them could not read and had no address. They slipped through the government net. He helped them, stood up for their rights, and did all that lay in his power on their behalf. He really loved them all, and they in their turn respected and loved him. Sometimes he asked their advice about things they really knew about. He was always ready to learn. And once he took me with him to visit old George, whom he had heard was ill. He slept in a hayloft in one of the farms, and we climbed up a ladder into the loft. They lay George on a sort of camp bed, with a blanket over him, and fleas crawling and hopping visibly about him. Sometimes Father did a little coaching, but again he hated charging a fee. Other children would join us in the Litchfield School for certain lessons, and once a little girl came every day for a while during a long visit to the village. Before he came to Somerset, he had had older students who came regularly. Not so many of those were around in the Ashcot of that time, although all that was soon to change. One of his friends was starting what was then a new school at Street. Millfield was within a few years to become internationally famous, but I remember two or three of its first teachers riding through the village on their bicycle in the early days. We were so proud of Father and admired him greatly. He had a gift for organising events in the village. He was a very able chairman when there were meetings. He enjoyed election campaigns, and so did we. For a while, Bridgewater was fortunate in having an excellent MP in Vernon Bartlett. He came to our house a couple of times, and we felt we knew him. He could speak seven languages. Father used to chair the meeting before the elections, and I still recall the thrill when Vernon was elected. It is because I had so loving a father that I have always found it easy and natural to think of God as our Father. I know how much fathers love, and how endless is their patience, and when necessary, their forgiveness. But now we have reached September 1946, and Boo and I are about to begin a wholly new kind of life as we pack our few belongings into a suitcase and set out for Glastonbury to become pupils at the convent boarding school.